I hear this all the time now, all these people on YouTube and TikTok and you name it, things I've never heard of. Why are they influencers? I'm not influenced by anybody. I'm inspired by a lot of people. And this is probably why I like to be in higher education, because I'm inspired by young people. In my own team here in UNESCO right now, I've got 4 interns and 5 project officers, all of which are under 30. And they teach me day by day. They are the future, and they are the people literally who inspire me.
Welcome to Higher Ed Without Borders, a production of Edu Alliance, a podcast series dedicated to education professionals worldwide. Each episode is a conversation with thought leaders that will enlighten and provide some new thoughts on critical issues facing higher education. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Welcome to Higher Ed Without Borders, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Dean Hoke in Bloomington, Indiana, and with me is my co-host, Dr. Central Nathan in United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi. Central, I don't know about you, but we're actually starting to feel fall here, which is something I've been looking forward to. How are you doing, and how is everything?
Dean, I'm doing well. Joining us today is Dr. Peter Wells. Peter is chief of the section for higher education at the UNESCO headquarters in Paris, where he is the secretary to the UNESCO Conventions on the Recognition of Higher Education Qualifications for Academic Mobility. He's also responsible for the overall coordination of the UNIDWIN, UNESCO Chairs Program, and most recently for the UNESCO Third World Conference on Higher Education. But before taking this current role, Peter was the director of Bucharest College, prior to that, a higher education program specialist at UNESCO. And actually, our paths crossed when he was the academic chair at the Higher Colleges of Technology, UAE. And also, he served as a lecturer at the Polish Open University, a special education consultant at the Council on Foreign Relations and Political Risk Analyst at Euler-Hermes. And Peter holds a bachelor's in European Studies from the University of Leicester, a master's in International Relations and Affairs from Florida State, and a doctor of philosophy in quality enhancement and tertiary education from the Lucian Blaga University of Sibiu in Romania. Dean?
Peter, good day to you, and how are you doing?
I'm very pleased to be joining you both here for this session, and I look forward to the conversation. And greetings from Paris, where it is still summer, I can tell you.
I'm very jealous. Well, let's go ahead and begin. Many of our listeners may not really be aware of UNESCO and how it fits, particularly in the field of higher education. Why don't we start there? Why don't you tell us a little bit about UNESCO's involvement in higher education?
For sure. And thank you very much again. Within the UN system, as many of your listeners may know, UNESCO is has a mandate for education, science and culture, hence the UNESCO Education, Science and Culture Organization. However, within the system, the UNESCO is the only agency with a mandate to operate within higher education. And that's the area that I and my colleagues work together on. What's probably, maybe I should say this too, that I think in globally, the term UNESCO is often possibly more associated with cultural heritage. Yeah. I think that would be, you know, without being too direct about it, I think that's when you talk about UNESCO, it's all about heritage. And people often forget that it's UNESCO is education, science, culture, and communication information. So therefore, within the UNESCO education sector where I work, and also there specifically on higher education, what we do is we work together with our member states, 193 member states around the world, to support them in their activities and their reform initiatives on higher education. And these have changed and evolved a lot over the last, I could say, 20 years, certainly the last decade. Specifically now, what we focus on is supporting enhancements of quality assurance in higher education, both internal quality assurance processes and mechanisms at the tertiary higher education institutional level, but also the systems. And this is something that was very well articulated, as Sentil said at the World Conference in May this year. But also what we focus on is trying to enhance systems' ability to, of systems of higher education, to address the needs of the local communities, of the national development agendas. So this is, of course, it includes aspects of inclusion and access to higher education. I could possibly refer back to the Millennium Development Goals. And the Millennium Development Goals were, to a certain extent, more prioritizing access for young people or people to primary and secondary education. And more or less, that may have been a success. Success then led to a driven demand for greater access to post-secondary education, tertiary, higher education. And this is where the SDGs came into play, because the SDGs make it quite clear that university tertiary education is important. So that's where we now come in from UNESCO's point of view, a point of departure, to support national systems, national higher education systems, national tertiary systems, to enhance the quality of provision, access opportunities, inclusive opportunities for the greater number of graduates from the secondary level. And I should say, it's really not all about numbers. It's not about numbers. It's about ensuring that people at all ages, of course, we're talking lifelong learning opportunities here, not just high school graduates, lifelong learning opportunities for everybody to access tertiary higher education opportunities. Once they graduate, do they get access to jobs, the labor market, at the level of their qualification? Because let's be very honest here. There's no point in having a bachelor's degree or even a master's degree if you end up driving a taxi.
It's a very good point. Central?
Yeah. Peter, you've seen higher education in many countries, and you worked yourself. You've been a student and now as an educator, as well as now in your current role in UNESCO. So from a personal perspective, this is not reflecting what UNESCO feels, but as an individual, when you see globally, you already hinted at many issues that are facing higher education, tertiary education. What do you think are some high priority issues? You talked about increased access, improving quality, skill development, employability. And we also have STEM and Industry 4.0 kind of programs. And there are some countries which with tremendous faculty shortage, need for faculty development, and money resources are always tight around the world, developed or developing world. And the particular problems in some areas in sub-Saharan Africa and India and other countries where you have the youth bulge and higher education. And there are other areas like the Middle East where you have migrants and refugees. And school preparation, Peter, you and I worked in higher colleges where this was a big issue for college work. And ultra-nationalism, which pops up both in Europe and the US, which works against international student movements. And there are a number of these issues. As you look at all these, what kind of pops into your mind as one or two top issues?
From my experience, and actually not really my experience, from what I see globally from UNESCO's from a UNESCO lens, is that I think one of the key problems is curricula and assessment. I think that in so many cases, and this is not finger pointing, but in so many cases, institutions, programs, possibly even systems, we are still regurgitating old curricula, because curricula need to change and they need to reflect the external communities that institutions serve. Not just at not necessarily at a national level, but at the community level. And often I think we miss that purpose of higher education institutions, that they serve the communities, the local communities. The curricula often is outdated and needs to be reformed or needs to be updated. I also see a problem often with how we assess knowledge, acquisition, learning, skills. There's a lot to talk about skills and competencies, but often the assessment of skills and competencies at the tertiary level is, or higher education level, is far weaker than those at the secondary and primary level. And again, this is a continuation of old practices, or I could even say last century practices, that if we've always taught like this, we've always had the curriculum like this, we've always assessed like this, and therefore we always award the grades like this, and therefore the qualifications like this. And that is something that really is a difficult mindset to change, but has to do. It has to change in terms of what we teach, how individuals learn, how we assess what individuals know, can do, competencies, weaving in skills and all the transferable skills that we talk about these days, which are across cross-disciplinary subjects, whether it be STEM, IT, teacher training, the humanities, the arts, the performing arts, etc. So I think that's one of the things I would say, that it's not just me talking about this. This is what the global community came to address at the World Conference. They also came to address linking in to all of the skills, competencies, knowledge, and awareness of all of the SDGs. Now, you mentioned in the introduction there SDG 4, but higher education, secondary education, and indeed primary education all need to address each of the 16, possibly 17 of the SDGs. Mm-hmm. And that's such a priority for young people, the youth, like I say, all the way from, we are seeing this in nursery schools. Nursery schools are talking about SDGs. Sometimes higher education institutions are not. Why is that? Because it's the future of the planet. It's the SDGs that will decide how we as a world community react. And higher education has a very, very strong role in doing that across all disciplines. So maybe I'll stop there.
Peter, let's switch a little bit and let's talk about you from a personal point of view. A lot of the people that we interview come to their positions in various ways. I mean, some had never been in higher education and they had ended up becoming university presidents. But you've kind of taken a path of always being in the higher education sector, even now in your work with the United Nations and UNESCO. And that seems to be your path and where you've been since the beginning. I'm kind of curious about that. I mean, what led you down that path? And furthermore, let's talk about some of the influences, some of the mentors that brought you along.
Well, thank you, Dean. I should fess up here and say that actually I have a very, very strangled route into my current role. I started out I'm not going to go through my CV, but I started out and went into the world of finance as a credit underwriter, a political underwriter. But I always knew that what I really wanted to stay in education because I loved school. I loved university, bachelor's, master's, and then eventually at the postgraduate level. And it was just something that really struck with me. I just loved it. So how did I end up where I am? That's a long, uninteresting story. But I would say this, I'm not comfortable with your question about influencers.
Why?
Because I hear this all the time now, these people on YouTube and TikTok and you name it, things I've never heard of. Why are they influencers? I'm not influenced by anybody. I'm inspired by a lot of people. And this is probably why I like to be in higher education, because I'm inspired by young people. In my own team here in UNESCO right now, I've got 4 interns and 5 project officers, all of which are under 30. And they teach me day by day. They are the future. And they are the people literally who inspire me. I can talk to you about individuals. I mean, Benjamin Zander, Professor Benjamin Zander, he's one of my go-to books. If you haven't read The Art of Possibility, read it. He is somebody I like to read. There's many people I like to read, but I'm influenced by the people around me. And I I'm surrounded, but if I surround myself with people who are young, vibrant, they are the new generation. And I have great colleagues too. And around the world, that's who influences me. I don't have all the answers, and I seek answers from everybody else. So I think, you know, well, I firmly believe, but it's the people that you surround yourself with who influence you and maybe dictate who your opinions. And I have my opinions too, but influencers, I'm not, that's not for me.
Well, Peter, let me follow up with that just a tad here. I think one of the things I just heard there is how much, whether you call it influence, amazed, whatever the case may be, about your younger staff. In other words, the junior staff and how they get to you and how they make you think. And it probably times a challenge. Is there a lesson to be learned there for young presidents? Is there something within the world of academia and presidents and provosts and people that are in charge? Should they, besides people, white-haired people like me, should they also be having a younger group around them, giving them a, shall we say, a different point of view or a different form of energy? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, in my experience, it is the talented young people. I mean, it's a definition of young, of course, but all the people I have, they are graduates of one level or another. But it is definitely the inspiration for what we do in UNESCO, in the UNESCO, in the education sector. But also, I see it in universities around the world, wherever I go. It's always the younger recent graduates or maybe early researchers or junior professors who have the energy and the vitality to change. I was in Tanzania just before the summer in July. We had a roundtable discussion at two universities there in Dar es Salaam and in Mbeya. And the average age of these young junior academics, associate professors, I don't know exactly what their titles were, they must have been 30, and they were extraordinary. They wanted to see their university flourish. They wanted to change the curricula. They wanted to change how they assess skills and knowledge. They wanted to change the dynamics of their programs. They wanted to change the curricula. They wanted to change the learning modalities to put more courses online, partially online, distance, OBTL. They were the pioneers. Luckily, in both instances, the rectors of the universities were fully behind them. They are the future when you look to reforming and changing higher education. And that's what, I suppose, coming back to your original question, they are, outside of my team here, they are my influencers in the field.
Very good. Central?
Yeah. Peter, as I work in this region, Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia, myself and many others here, we really champion STEM Industry 4.0 and vocational skill development, stuff like micro-credentials, things like that, primarily for employability of a large group of youth who are coming up, coming of age. At the same time, I wonder when we do this in this region, particularly probably worldwide, is there an increasing risk for arts and humanities areas in higher education? Would these regions, you know, kind of treat arts and humanities as a secondary thing? And so in general, how do you see the development of higher education in fine arts, visual arts, performing arts, those kind of things? You already kind of hinted at that in your talk about UNESCO.
Yes, I think you've raised a very good point and a very good concern there. I can't speak for, of course, the global community, but there is a risk. There is a risk that the more we focus on STEM or STEAM, as it is now, Industry 4.0 vocational, the more potential there is for the humanities, the visual arts, the performing arts to be sidelined from the higher education ecosphere. But I don't think, I think one of the things that we forget is that when we talk about the visual arts or the performing arts, the social, the human science, the humanities, is that they are also part of our development curricula and the SDG agenda. You can't have, you need to have historians. You need to have the arts. You need to have all of the humanities. But I think one of the things, what I was going to say is that when I have had discussions with faculties and professors and departments, particularly in the humanities, let's say faculties of letters or the languages, etc., they always say, oh, you know, SDGs is nothing to do with us. What do you mean it's nothing to do with you? Well, because we, you know, which is the faculty of philology, French philology, or it's a faculty of Latin or ancient Greek. Well, what do you do in that faculty? What is your curriculum like? Are you trying to tell me that none of your students have got any idea about the world outside of French literature, for example? Well, I think that's a dereliction of duty.
Yeah.
Because if you are teaching French literature, French language and literature and cultural studies, for example, then when you are examining French language, why aren't you examining French language from a perspective of one or more of the SDGs? Because you're still looking at French language. So I don't see that the two things are completely disconnected. And I think if you delve into any of the humanities, the arts, the performing arts, the fine arts, why are you not asking your students to look at the world around them from a perspective of the planet and define that in their artistic endeavors, be it visual or fine arts or performing arts? So I do find it sometimes a little bit irresponsible that I'm not saying that everything has to be molded around the SDGs, of course, and not everything has to be molded about around your future careers. I mean, if you're in a dance academy and an act studio, then hopefully you will become an actor. But you can also be a little bit aware about the world around you. So I'm not sure I've really answered your question, but I do find it sometimes a little bit this disconnect between vocational and STEM, STEAM, and then on the humanities the other side. But the humanities, we are all humans. We're all part of humanity. And so I would never want to see the demise of the humanities against IT, vocational, STEM work.
Yeah.
Peter, let's continue to talk a little bit about teaching, but how it's been done over the past 2 to 3 years really has changed, and almost out of necessity. And that's quite frankly, had to do with the pandemic, that most of us, even though we had maybe been involved in online or face-to-face, all of a sudden we had an epidemic of unprecedented proportions worldwide, and there had to be a switch in order to continue things. And we're past that certain point, but I think there's probably been some lessons learned in terms of the future on that. And that's what I want to talk to you about. I'd like to know about how you see the challenges and opportunities for online learning, particularly in the field of higher education and in the developing world, where it had not been such a influence, again, my word, as you might see in the United States or in some places in Europe. What's your thoughts on that?
Yes, I think, I mean, it certainly is a buzz topic right now, if we can allow ourselves to call it post-pandemic. I've said this a few times before. Honestly, I think, and it sounds a little bit awkward to say this, but one of the positives of the pandemic and the COVID-19 for higher education was that I genuinely believe we took a leap forward, a 10-year leap forward in 2 years. It would have taken 10 years for us to come to the point in higher education, teaching and learning, to accept that actually you can teach and learn online. This has been something that's been on the agenda for 20 years, and it's always been, well, I won't go as far to say ridiculed, but it's always been dismissed as, no, you can't possibly do quality online higher education, teaching, learning, and assessment. Suddenly, we took, literally in 2 years, we advanced a decade. Suddenly, overnight, it had to happen, because learning doesn't stop, higher education couldn't stop, and suddenly institutions, programs, all had to go online. And so I see that as a big leap forward, like I say, a decade leap forward, a positive of going from can't do it to have to do it, and therefore could do it and can do it and did do it within the period of, well, I was going to say in 2 years, but in some cases, most cases, it was in the period of like 1 month. So that I see as a positive, that now there is an experience of being able to offer learning, higher education learning opportunities, courses online. It also, during this pandemic, this 2 year period, exposed, of course, some weaknesses to that can do. And the weaknesses have two prongs to it. One is teaching pedagogy. Now, I'm sorry to have put it quite so bluntly, but I'm sorry, poor teaching in the classroom face to face is poor teaching online. And I think this has exposed a little bit of some of the weaknesses in some systems and some institutions of the didactics, the pedagogy of teaching and learning in higher education. At the same time, it's also exposed, by virtue of how difficult it is to do assessment online, assessment of knowledge, skills acquisition online. So, for example, a normal exam situation or a normal assessment scenario where students sit in an exam room monitored physically, that couldn't happen during the pandemic because they had to be done online. And if it's done online, then you have to rethink about how am I going to assess the standard or the knowledge acquisition skills of my students. So I think I'm kind of highlighting sort of the positive and then the negative. And now I think it's really revolutionized. Now, maybe that's a little bit strong, but made people rethink, okay, how do I teach? How do my students learn? How do I assess them? How do I assess their knowledge and skills? And I think that is a positive, but that is where we are right now. Yes, it's widened access. Of course, it means that far more students or potential learners, not just in full-time courses, but in short courses, different types of micro-credentials, etc., they can access higher education remotely because now we've proved it can be done. But now we have to stop and ask ourselves, okay, how do we monitor the quality or how do we assure quality online learning in the same way as we assure quality on-campus learning, and the same for assessments and the same for student experience. But I think we've leapt forward a long way, and now we just need to start thinking about how we can quality assess or quality assure the quality provision of a new era. But that era wouldn't have happened, I don't believe, as soon as it did without the pandemic.
Very good. Central, you have the last question.
Yeah. Just a quick last question, Peter. Many people may understand UNESCO as working with the governments, ministries, government departments, and so on. But an individual university or a college, private or public, can they work with UNESCO? If yes, how can they do that?
Well, yeah, yes. I mean, of course, we're in governmental organization, but one thing I think maybe a little misunderstanding or misapprehension is that, you know, UNESCO or any other UN agencies, UNHCR, UNDP, UNICEF, the World Bank, you know, we are not agencies full of all the answers and all of the expertise. That's not how it works. What we can do is we can bring in expertise from around the world to support individual initiatives or requests for support, technical assistance, reform initiatives. So I mentioned I was in Tanzania, and by chance we were with the Minister of Higher Education, and he said that there was a plan to establish 14 new universities in Tanzania, technical universities. By chance, with me, I had a consultant who was from Ireland. And Ireland did exactly the same thing, completely by coincidence, established 14 new technical universities 15 years ago. And I was like, well, okay, this is the sort of person you need to talk to. You need to talk to this person and those universities in Ireland. They are the expertise that you need to help you with your ministry plan in Tanzania. And so it's not just UNESCO bringing all the knowledge, it's bringing in our expertise, EduAlliance. I need people to come in and do this. This is what we do. We also have the UNESCO chairs, UniTwin Network, which is established, which is around 820, I believe, university chairs around the world who cooperate in 120 countries, but also with their networks themselves. So it's actually a spider web of probably more like 3,000 institutions. Mm. But what institutions can do is reach out to UNESCO to say, listen, we can offer support to other institutions. This is what we do. So therefore, the North-South cooperation is emboldened and is encouraged and is supported by universities, higher education institutions.
Yeah, good advice. Lee?
Peter and Central, I'm afraid we're out of time. I'd like to thank our very special guest today, and that's Dr. Peter Wells, Chief of Section for Higher Education at UNESCO headquarters, located in Paris. This concludes our episode of Higher Education Without Borders. If you'd like, of course, to comment on today's show and suggest future guests, feel free to go to www.higheredwithoutborders.com, the comments section. And as I always say on every show, yes, we actually do read the comments. So please do write to us and let us know what you think. On behalf of Central Nathan, Dr. Peter Wells, Edge Alliance, and myself, thank you. And make sure to subscribe via your favorite podcast app. Thank you.
This has been a production of Edu Alliance, an international higher education consulting firm with offices in Abu Dhabi and Bloomington, Indiana. Nathan and Hoke, along with their team of experienced professionals, have assisted universities worldwide. To learn more about Edu Alliance, go to our website, www.edualliancegroup.com. You will find details on our podcast, contact information, and our services. Thank you.